terrifying swath through the gay community. But the gay population at Vassar seemed more angry than scared. 90 miles south in New York City, Larry Kramer was sending up his clarion cry of outrage, and the mostly well-to-do, mostly white sons and daughters of Vassar were complying, in spades. They organized, marched, protested, heckled, debated, and demanded. Outrage, Jack learned, was not an aphrodisiac. It was exhausting. Jack wasn't against activism precisely, but campus politics seemed trivial to him, almost laughable. It was activism of the easiest sort, run by idealistic youth barely out of their teens who never left the peachy enclave of their campus in Poughkeepsie. Enlightenment fueled by a heightened sense of mortality was certainly logical, but it also seemed blatantly self-serving in a way that infuriated Jack. Years later, he would experience the same intolerance about the surge of patriotism that swept through New York after 9/11. The run on American flags by people who would also confess, in lowered tones, how they'd recently put their place on the market while looking at houses in New Jersey or Connecticut, or in their hometowns somewhere in the Midwest. Nobody's flying a plane into the Gateway Arch. True patriotism, Jack believed, would have been for his fellow Americans to look inward after 9/11 and accept a little blame, admit the attacks had happened, in part, because of who they were in the world, not in spite of it. But no. Suddenly, at every public function, his previously godless neighbors would stand with hands on heart to earnestly intone the Pledge of Allegiance and sing, "God Bless America." "I wish Kate Smith had never been born," Jack said at a dinner party one night, inciting a nasty argument about patriotism and its relative merits. The woman sitting across the table went on and on about the duties of civilians during wartime and in the face of terrorism, until he broke off a piece of his baguette and threw it at her. He'd meant to startle her, shut her up, not hit her square on the chin. He and Walker had missed dessert. The mini ACT-UP protests at Vassar felt self-indulgent to Jack. How daring was it to stage a kiss-in in front of one of the most sexually diverse and accepting populations for miles and miles? It had all felt frivolous and half-assed and bloated with self-regard. Still, when Jack's best friend at college, Arthur, took a job with the gay men's health crisis and invited Jack to share an apartment on Barrow Street, Jack jumped at the chance. He would have preferred Chelsea, where the gay scene was a little younger, a little more hip. But Barrow Street was great. Barrow Street was classy in a way Chelsea wasn't, historical, only blocks away from the Stonewall Inn. Sure, he told Arthur, he'd be thrilled to volunteer at GMHC, was desperate to get to the front lines, do something that mattered. But what Jack really wanted was to have sex. Not earnest, leftist, collegiate sex, sex that required far too much conversation and not nearly enough lube, but Greenwich Village, Christopher Street, drop your pants but leave on those leather chaps, mindless, mind-blowing, anonymous sex. So it was with a certain karmic comeuppance, Jack would realize later, that mere months after arriving in the West Village, he would meet the love of his life, Walker Bennett. Walker liked to say that he'd been born gay and middle-aged. He'd grown up in Greenwich Village. His parents were roving adjunct professors, self-anointed socialists who intermittently practiced open marriage and dabbled in bisexuality, and refused the tenure track because it was nothing more than a union to protect the interests of the already coddled upper class. When Walker came out to them in high school, it had all the Sturm und Drang of him announcing that he was switching from violin to cello. Early on, Walker knew he wanted a different kind of life from his parents who lived paycheck to paycheck, collected furniture on the street the night before the bulk garbage pickups, counted coins in the sofa cushion to pay for takeout fried rice. After graduating from law school in the mid-1980s, he returned to the West Village, planning to work at the same corporate firm where he'd done his summer internship, only to find himself deluged by neighbors and old family friends, mostly gay men, who were suddenly getting sick and dying in alarming numbers and under mysterious circumstances. They wanted Walker to help them write a will or fight an eviction or understand their disability insurance. Within months, Walker had more work than he could handle, some funneled to him from GMHC, some from the prominent, often still closeted gay business community. They trusted Walker. The premium he charged his wealthier clients allowed him to take on a lot of work pro bono, which he loved. After only 1 year, he was able to hire help, rent office space. Soon he was a neighborhood fixture. Walker, the genial, slightly overweight neighborhood attorney who would handle pretty much anything, even if you were broke, especially if you were queer. The night Walker met Jack, he'd wandered into the raucous bar down near the Christopher Street Pier on a whim. He usually preferred the quieter gay watering holes, but he'd had a long day. He was still in his work clothes, and as he made his way through the lively Friday night crowd, he spotted Jack, who was difficult not to notice, bare-chested and wearing extremely short shorts, dancing by himself ecstatically to I Will Survive. Walker hated that stupid fucking song. Everyone around them was most assuredly not surviving. Two of his clients, both sick and quarantined at St. Vincent's, had died that week, making six in just the last month. He needed a drink. He needed to get really, really drunk. As he approached the bar, Jack started waving at him, calling him over. Walker wondered if they'd met before. Was he a client? A friend of a client? "Have we met?" he yelled at Jack, trying to be heard above the deafening, thumping disco beat. Jack shook his head no and looked Walker up and down. Then he leaned close to Walker's ear. His cheek was damp and smelled of perspiration and some kind of too-sweet cologne. "That suit looks really uncomfortable," Jack said, his voice hoarse from singing. He handed Walker a shot of tequila. And in a move so out of character, so weirdly un-Walker-like and spontaneous and defiant and hopeful, Walker tipped back the shot, swallowed, put the empty glass on the bar, grabbed the back of Jack's sweaty head, and kissed him full on the lips. Jack kissed Walker back, then pulled away and grinned and said, "How about we start the weekend by undoing that belt?" They'd been together ever since. Standing at his and Walker's bedroom window in Greenwich Village, technically the far, far West Village, their building was as far west as you could go without living on a houseboat in the Hudson, Jack watched a Carnival cruise ship glide up the center of the river, heading to collect its passengers at Pier 88. He'd probably see the boat later that evening being tugged in reverse until it reached the open harbor and could swing south. A cruise sounded good to Jack right now. Anything to get him out of New York and to take his mind off Leo and his massive Leo-related migraine. The afternoon was so cold that the bike paths along the river were deserted. The Christopher Street Pier across the way was no longer the decrepit, free-for-all cruising spot it had been when he and Walker moved in more than 20 years ago, a place you could go for an easy afternoon frolic or to sunbathe nude when the weather was fine. Giuliani had cleaned up the piers and transformed the entire waterfront into sanitized paths and mini-parks for walkers and bikers and strollers. "Fooliani," Walker would say. He'd hated Giuliani's particular brand of dictatorship almost as much as he'd hated Koch's insistence on remaining closeted. Even scrubbed, the pier remained a gathering place for gay youth. No matter how biting the cold, there were always a few hardy souls out, huddled, trying to shield their cigarette lighters from the wind. Jack wondered why they weren't at school, if they were there because they didn't have anywhere else to go. He envied the teens on the waterfront, hopping up and down to stay warm, drinking beer from a paper bag. No cares, no worries. What did you have to worry about at 17 when you were young and untethered and in New York City? How bad could it be, really? Did kids even worry about being gay? Worry about having to tell their families? He wished that was all he had to agonize about. He'd give anything for that to be the thing he needed to confess. Jack took out his phone and opened Stalkerville. Melody had shown him the day they had lunch, and although he'd made fun of it, he also hadn't objected when she downloaded it to his phone and connected him to Walker. It's addictive, she said. You'll see. The whole thing perplexed Walker. I always tell you where I am. I'm always at work or with you anyway. Why do you need to check on your phone? I don't, Jack said. It's just interesting to know I can. Creepy, but interesting. And it was creepy. But Jack had to admit that Melody was right. It was also addictive. Opening the screen and seeing the icon of Walker's face appear and then the roaming blue dot. At the drugstore, at the grocery, at his office. Right now, he was at the gym. Probably sitting in the sauna instead of exercising. Thinking about what to make for dinner. Something about being able to see Walker move around during the day, seeing how connected their lives were, how small Walker's world was, how much of it revolved around him, them, made the financial mess he was in feel even worse. Jack didn't think about this too often anymore, but he knew he was probably alive because of Walker. When he met Walker all those years ago, in the midst of his freewheeling days in Chelsea, on Fire Island, in the bathhouses and the clubs, Walker had been the one to insist on condoms, to demand fidelity. Jack had taken umbrage at first. Hardly any of the couples they knew were exclusive. They were young and out and living in the greatest city in the world. But Walker recognized what Jack refused to face then. Men getting sick. Being denied treatment. Dying. Walker worked with the doctors at St. Vincent's. He believed what they told him about prevention. And he scared the shit out of Jack. If you want to spend every morning checking your exquisitely beautiful body for sores that won't heal, or worry about every little cough, that's your choice, Walker had said in the early weeks. But it's not mine. Walker was scrupulous. Condoms and fidelity were non-negotiable. If you want to mess around, that's fine, Walker said. Just not while I'm in the picture. Jack tried to resist Walker at first, but found himself drawn to the man in ways he didn't understand and couldn't explain. Something about Walker. His goodness, his compassion, and, okay, the size of his dick, Walker was huge, was more compelling than sleeping around. It was one of the nicest things Jack could say about himself, that he had recognized the value of Walker. Before they moved in together, they'd both gotten tested, and Jack didn't think he'd ever been as scared as the day they went to get their results. They had collapsed into each other's arms, weeping and laughing with relief when they were negative. Walker had saved his life. He was sure of that. And if that certainty created a certain inequity in their relationship, a certain kind of paternalistic vibe that, Jack could admit, was sometimes not particularly sexy, not very hot, if sometimes Jack resented Walker's saintliness, his goodness and light and responsibility, and needed to act out a little, spend money he didn't have, very occasionally and very discreetly have a late night with someone who didn't need to floss and brush and shave and apply moisturizer before dropping his pants, well, what of it? There was still a part of Jack that wondered what it would have been like if he hadn't heeded Walker's advice, had thrown caution to the wind and spent a little more time sleeping around before he settled down. Maybe he would be dead, but maybe he wouldn't. Maybe he'd be just fine, alive and better for the breadth of his experience. If Walker hadn't kissed him that very first night, maybe he wouldn't even be in this mess. At his shop, Jack opened the rolling gate and unlocked the door. He'd spent all week going through his inventory, trying to see if he had anything tucked away he'd forgotten about that he could sell to raise some cash. Knowing the whole time he didn't. He knew his inventory down to every cast-off crystal doorknob. Whenever he found something of worth, which he did frequently, he had an eye, he knew exactly whom to call to place it. It was rare for something of true worth to linger at Jack's shop. His lucrative dealings were all private transactions with his longtime customers, designers, architects, and the esteemed ladies of the Upper East Side. The economic downturn had brought most of that business to a halt, too. Things were starting to pick up, but there wasn't time for him to accumulate anywhere near the money he needed. If Jack didn't have a photo of the damaged Rodin sculpture on his phone, he would have thought he'd imagined the whole thing. Back at home, after the aborted visit to Leo, it had only taken a few minutes on the computer to realize why it looked familiar, that it was one of the recovered pieces of art from the World Trade Center site that he'd read about years and years ago. The story was a tiny blip in the midst of all the coverage about the cleanup, how a damaged cast of Rodin's The Kiss had been recovered and then mysteriously disappeared. Jack had paid attention at the time because of his very good customer who collected Rodin. Jack didn't know what to do with the information he had. He could do nothing, of course. He didn't care about the security guard in Stephanie's house or the statue, really. He could call someone at the 9/11 Memorial Museum that was underway and tip them off, anonymously, or as himself. Maybe there was a reward, maybe he'd get some press, and it would be good for his business. Or, and this option was the one he was trying and failing to resist, he could approach Tommy O'Toole and offer to broker a sale for a sum of money Jack was certain so significant that Tommy wouldn't be able to refuse. And Jack's sizable commission would solve his immediate financial problems, release him from whatever Leo might or might not do. He went to his little back office and printed out the photos of the sculpture from his phone. Jack had asked around, and his friend Robert knew someone, some guy named Bruce, who worked in the shadier places of art and antique sales. "I used him once," Robert said. "He'll know what to do. Tell him you're my friend." It didn't hurt to ask, Jack thought. It never hurt to gather information and know all the possibilities. Before putting on his coat, he took out his phone and the card stowed away in his pocket and dialed the number. "Hey," he said to some guy named Bruce. "I'm Robert's friend. I'm on my way." Chapter 18. Leo was home alone, sitting in Stephanie's tiny second-floor back room, the space he'd appropriated as his office, trying to work out his pitch for Nathan, whom he was finally scheduled to meet with later in the week. Out the window, the bare January trees and leafless shrubbery allowed him full purview of all the neighboring yards to the side and the rear. He could see straight down into the kitchen of the brownstone directly behind Stephanie's. The layout just like hers, but reversed. The rooms a little more colorful, maybe a little shabbier. A spindly blonde in black jeans and a baggy red sweater was arranging an array of sliced fruit on a plate for two little boys bouncing and swiveling on breakfast stools at the island counter. The boys were the same size and coloring, twins probably. Leo wondered when twins had become as common as the common cold. He thought of Melody's daughters, who, he dimly remembered, were a happy accident. She probably hated that people assumed she'd had some kind of fertility treatment, that she and Walter didn't get credit for two of his determined sperm successfully penetrating two of her enterprising ova. That type of thing would drive her crazy. He watched as one of the kids across the way shoved his brother off the seat and out of sight, presumably down to the floor because the mother raced over and bent down, and when she stood, the boy was in her arms, his legs wrapped around her waist, his face buried in her shoulder. He could see the boy's shoulders heaving, the mother stroking his back and mouthing shh, shh, gently rocking him back and forth. In the house next to hers, a middle-aged man walked through his kitchen with someone who looked like a contractor. The contractor was pointing at the ceiling molding with an extension of measuring tape while the homeowner nodded. Back to the right, Red Sweater Mom opened her back door and dumped a plate of fruit peels into what he guessed was a compost bin. He found the tableau behind Stephanie's house endlessly entertaining. He could sit and watch all the quiet lives of aspiration play out for hours. It was strangely soothing. Brooklyn was growing on him. Though Stephanie hadn't been kidding about the drugs or borrowing money, not that he was using any drugs at the moment, not that he needed to ask for money, she'd been a pushover about the sex. They'd spent most of the power outage in bed, undressed, making their bodies sing the old familiar tune. "You can stay until you find a place," she'd said a few days later. Victoria finally shipped Leo his belongings, no more than a dozen boxes, he didn't want much. It took leaving his life with Victoria to understand how much of it had been constructed by her using his money, in a way he didn't miss and certainly wasn't eager to recreate. The relentlessly neutral palette with splashes of dark brown or black. "It's like living in a gigantic portobello mushroom," he'd complained to her once. The spare modern furniture, the sterile metallic Italian light fixtures, her quirky and, as it turned out, nearly worthless taste in a handful of upcoming but still wildly pricey artists. He was ecstatic to leave it all behind. Aside from recovering the years of his life he'd spent wooing, winning, and then regretting her, all he wanted from Victoria were a smattering of personal belongings and a few boxes of old speakeasy files. He unpacked the clothes he needed and stored the rest in Stephanie's basement. They were calling it temporary. When Stephanie first told him about Nathan Chowdhury's alleged new project, he'd managed to keep a neutral face. "I'm not sure exactly what it is," she'd said. "We were at a party, and it was very loud and incredibly hot, and, you know, he was classic Nathan, going a million miles a minute in 17 different directions. Genuine writers, irreverent but vigorous, smart but sexy, bloody brilliant." She did a decent impression of him and his vaguely British accent, left over from his early years in Kilburn. "Maybe you should call him," she'd said, a little too casually. "Maybe he needs a content guy." "Maybe." What Stephanie had described was not a new idea of Nathan's. It was an old idea of Leo's. Back when Speakeasy Media was generating new sites faster than they could have imagined, Leo had wanted to create a writing hub. Something that would have a separate identity and attract serious writers, fiction and nonfiction, reportage, high-level think pieces. They had to focus on gossip at first because it was cheap and easy and fun and people would read it. But once they had a little traction, a little more money, Leo wanted to balance the gossip and blind items with something respectable. First, they needed money, and gossip was where they'd find it. Interesting that Nathan, who hadn't been taken with Leo's idea back then, "You're describing a gaping sinkhole that will suck up money and not return a proper cent," was ready to revive the concept on his own. "Any specifics?" Leo asked Stephanie. "No, it sounded very early stage. He did say he was considering acquiring an existing publication to build around." Another idea of Leo's from back in the day. "He asked for suggestions. I told him to look at paper fibers." "He can do better than that." "Paul's respected, Leo. I respect him. He could use an influx of cash. And Paul does stuff with the public schools and literacy, and Nathan was also interested in the philanthropic angle."
"Since when is Nathan interested in philanthropy?"
"Since he got married and had a couple kids and is probably looking to impress the private school admissions committees. He went to Darfur a few months ago." Leo snorted a little. Literacy? Darfur? All he could think about in that moment was a particularly depraved evening at some bar on the Lower East Side one late, late night. Early morning? Probably. When a bleary-eyed Nathan outlined the Speakeasy Media financial model on a series of napkins. How they'd make their first million. How quickly he'd leverage it into more. How many people along the way would bend to his vision. Collateral damage. Can't be helped. How soon they'd be retired. Leo had sat next to him on the barstool, half listening, while an extravagantly pierced but fetching young musician flirted with him and then leaned against Nathan and then back into Leo, making her interest in both apparent.
"Do you guys want to come home with me?" she'd finally said as the bartender was ushering them out the door. "Both of you?"
He'd been relieved when Nathan passed out the second he landed on her sofa. If he was going to engage in a threesome, it wasn't going to be with Nathan. Pierced, as he sometimes still fondly thought of the musician, kept Leo up until sunrise. She taught him some things.
"I feel like Rip Van Winkle right now," Leo said to Stephanie. "Like I woke up, and everyone became their exact opposite. Paul Underwood's a literary force. Nathan's a philanthropist."
"Yeah, well, things changed while you were otherwise occupied." At first, Leo just pretended to be interested in Nathan's new venture,
a way to kill time while waiting for his divorce to be final, an amusing lark that would keep everyone off his back and halt all the lame suggestions about work. But the more he talked to Paul Underwood, the more he realized the potential sitting there untapped. Paul's content was stellar. Leo was impressed with who and what he was publishing. So was the layout, design, art. But everything else was dismal. The office was chaotic and inefficient, like almost anything in the publishing world. Without even trying, Leo could think of a dozen things they could do immediately to raise the profile and productivity of the magazine and expand in a multitude of interesting ways, starting with a more robust online presence. Social media, a blog, an app. Paper Fibers could, should, publish a handful of books every year. They needed a bigger staff. Once Leo decided to put a proposal together, take himself and Paul seriously, and approach Nathan with a multifaceted, well-thought-out plan for bolstering and expanding, he started having fun. His mood lifted. He was sleeping better than he had in years, waking up before Stephanie and going for a run in Prospect Park, no matter how cold. He spent his days reading, researching, thinking, and working so hard at times he lost track of time. He'd forgotten how good it felt to be interested, absorbed, stimulated. He made dinner some nights. Huevos rancheros, beef stew, French onion soup. "You're making me fat," Stephanie complained one night. "Don't let me have seconds." If he could get something going, Leo started to think that maybe he could borrow money to pay his family back and leave his investments intact. Maybe even borrow from Nathan. Rebuilding wasn't unthinkable. He'd done it all before. And if his efforts stopped being interesting, if he stopped having fun, he still had money in the bank, he still had options. Doing some research, putting together his ideas, meeting with Nathan, it would all be, to use one of Nathan's favorite expressions, win-fucking-win. Downstairs, the doorbell rang. Leo walked to the front bedroom and looked out the window. B was standing on the front stoop, shivering and clutching something in her arms. He went down and opened the door. "It's my stuff," she said, handing Leo a leather case he vaguely remembered buying for her ages and ages ago. "Meaning, I wrote those pages." "You still have this?" he said, examining the satchel. "I don't remember it being so nice. This is nice." "To be honest, I haven't used it in years. I thought it was lucky, and then I thought it was unlucky, and well, here it is, here they are, and here I am, ha!" Leo examined B's face, tried to make eye contact. She looked stoned. He undid the front straps and peered inside. "Lots of pages in here." "I think it's a quick read. I don't know what it is yet exactly, but..." B looked uncomfortable. "I was hoping you'd read and then pass along to Stephanie." "You want me to read it first?" he said, surprised. "Yes." She shoved her hands deep into her coat pockets and looked up at him with a weak smile. "Like the old days, huh?" Her face bloomed. She looked 18 again, eager and bright. "That would be nice. I miss the old days." Leo thought of the night of the hospital, B leaning close and saying, "I heard something else." He had an unexpected urge to bend down and hug her, tell her that whatever she was worried about was going to be okay, reassure her the way she'd done for him that night. As quickly as the odd inclination appeared, it was gone, and in its place a flash of annoyance, anger even. When was she going to grow up? He wasn't responsible for her, for reading her work anymore. "Okay, I'm looking forward to it, as soon as I can. Probably not this week." "No hurry. When you get to it, really." She wondered what had just happened. One minute Leo was there, and the next he wasn't. Confused, she stood and kept nodding at him until she started to look like one of those bobblehead dolls of Derek Jeter or the Pope. "Definitely stoned," Leo thought. "Do you want to come in?" he asked, impatient. "No, no, I have to get to work. I just wanted to drop that off." She sighed, and he thought he saw her shudder. I went to this party at Celia Baxter's. Lena Novak was there.
Shit. She must be a complete nightmare by now.
B gave a wan smile. She is such a fucking nightmare you wouldn't even believe.
I believe.
They both laughed a little and things seemed lighter again. Nice. B reached into her purse and pulled out a Ziploc bag of cookies.
I stole these from the party, she said, the entire platter.
I approve, he said. Not a Celia Baxter fan either. Leo had slept with Celia once, years ago, and when he didn't return her numerous calls, she'd shown up at his office, swollen-faced and crying and looking as if she hadn't showered in days.
Take them, B said, handing him the bag. I have tons more at home.
She gave him a quick peck on the cheek and headed off toward Flatbush Avenue, waving her hand a little behind her. He closed the door, opened the bag of cookies, and ate two. He took the leather case upstairs and put it on a shelf. He'd get to it after his meeting with Nathan. This week was all about Nathan. Chapter 19. Behind the wheel of her parked car and in spite of the cold, Melody had fallen deeply asleep. She was dreaming about her babies, how solid and steadying their weight was against her chest, on her lap, in her arms. Tap, 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 tap. Someone in her dream was tapping on a window, wanting to come in. Tap, tap. Melody jerked awake, and as the two figures standing outside the car lowered their grinning faces down to hers, she drew back, embarrassed and confused.
Too early for nap time, one of them said.
Melody smothered a groan and tried to smile. It was Jane Hamilton, another mother she knew from school, laughing as if she'd just told the world's most hilarious joke. This she did not need today.
Save the disco naps for the weekend, the other woman said.
Melody could never remember her name, the one with the oddly shaped curly hair she thought of as the poodle. Jane and the poodle were part of a clique. She'd resisted using that word at first, but incredibly, there was no other designation that fit the social stratifications of school parents, who occasionally included Melody in a monthly mom's night out. The evenings were usually at someone's house, when Melody would go because the drinks were free, or sometimes at a local bar, when she would not go and hope nobody noted the distinction. Everyone would swill Chardonnay, and the conversation would invariably turn into wine-lubricated screeching about sex, and how the husbands wanted it too often, and bargaining tips for blowjobs. Melody didn't want to hear about anyone's sex life, much less drunk suburban mothers who didn't even seem to like their spouses or their children all that much. Apart from the indecorousness of it all, which horrified her, she would never talk about Walt that way. She would never think about him that way. She thought the women were willfully shallow and tedious. Melody tended to sit through those evenings nearly silent, occasionally laughing along when everyone else laughed or nodding her head in agreement with some of the milder declarations about school. The kids had too much homework. The assistant principal was a bitch. The 11th grade English teacher was hot but definitely gay. Melody removed her keys from the ignition, grabbed her handbag, and opened the car door, bracing herself against the chill winter wind.
"We missed you at the meeting," the poodle said.
"What meeting?" Melody asked, alarmed. She never missed school meetings.
"Oh, she didn't need to be there," Jane said. "Plus, it was boring."
"So boring," the poodle said.
"What meeting?" Melody asked.
"The college financial aid thing," Jane said. "The forms and the requirements, blah, blah, blah."
"Oh." Melody realized with a sinking feeling that when she dutifully copied all the parent gatherings from the college counseling calendar into her own at the end of last summer, she'd ignored the workshops about financial aid. How had things changed so quickly? And how had she not remembered that pompous bit of editing sooner?
"I'm sorry I missed it," Melody said. "I meant to go. Is the information online?"
"I thought you were all set," Jane said. I thought you and Walt had been saving for college since your first date or something obnoxious like that.
Melody squirmed a little to remember how she'd bragged at one of the mom nights last spring. She hadn't explained about the nest per se, just mentioned that she and Walt had a college fund and that they probably wouldn't need financial aid. She'd regretted the words as soon as they'd tumbled out of her mouth, and now she could kick herself, especially thinking about her offhanded and inaccurate phraseology. We made saving a priority.
You know what investments are like these days, Melody said, inexperienced at posturing about money. She was probably the color of a beet. We might need some help after all.
Let me save you some time, said the poodle. You already make too much money, and the colleges don't care about kids from Westchester, so unless you guys are going to declare bankruptcy or somebody loses a job, you're toast. The whole meeting was a colossal waste of time.
They'll take one look at that scarf and kick you out, Jane said, gesturing at Melody's neck and the pretty lavender scarf Francie had given her.
It was a present, Melody said.
It's lovely, Jane said. It suits you.
At one time, Melody had wanted nothing more than to be friends with these women, would have loved nothing else than to bump into them in town and have them admire something she was wearing. Now she wanted to run and hide. Their conversations made her want to scream. They complained about money, while breathlessly recounting expensive house renovations. How many blowjobs for a sub-zero, she wanted to ask, or recent European vacations. How many for a trip to Paris? 10? 1? And then invariably they'd look at each other and shrug and say, luxury problems, cackling like some modern skinny jean-wearing equivalent of Marie Antoinette's court. That kale juice you're drinking is $6. Melody wanted to say, your kitchen is the size of my entire downstairs. They made her so angry and anxious, she'd gradually learned to avoid all of them. She fingered a corner of her pretty scarf and looked at her watch. I'd better get going, she said, gesturing to the consignment store behind them. I have to duck in here before I go home.
Nice, Jane nodded approvingly. A little retail therapy.
We just had a pleasant chat with Walt, too, the poodle said.
Walter?
Walt was supposed to be grocery shopping and not in the village where the only food stores were very precious and very expensive.
Where?
He's with Vivian, Jane said, pointing across the street.
Melody was grateful in that moment that she'd had so much practice not visibly reacting to these galling women because she was able to keep her face calm.
Right, of course, she said. See you later.
As she hurried, her heart was pounding so hard she thought it might cross the street ahead of her. She thought, in the moments before she charged through Vivian's door, that this must be what it was like to catch your husband with a lover. In flagrante delicto was the phrase that popped into Melody's head. A flagrant offense. Betrayal. This is how Victoria must have felt after Leo's accident, Melody realized, experiencing a tiny flash of empathy for the woman who had never even been civil to her. And as she stepped up on the curb, careful not to slip on the slightly icy walk, she knew she'd rather catch Walter in an amorous embrace with Vivian, would rather he have Vivian bent over the table in her office that was covered with local maps and magazines and restaurant coupons and be taking her from behind, than this. Calmly sitting at her desk, in plain sight at Reuben and Daughters Realty. Vivian Reuben was the realtor who'd sold them their house. Chapter 20. The first time Simone kissed Nora furtively in her family's kitchen, where they were momentarily alone because Louisa was down the hall in the bathroom, she moved swiftly. Before Nora understood what was happening, and retreated before Nora could object, or respond, or acquiesce, or participate. That afternoon, when Simone heard Louise's footsteps in the hall, she casually went back to spreading almond butter and jam on brown rice cakes. Nora couldn't fathom how Louisa could be oblivious to the new charge in the room, not even notice how the molecules in the kitchen had briefly combusted into something intoxicating and scalding, and then quickly resettled into the familiar tableau. Bowl of polished apples on a butcher block island, marble counter with a six-burner range, gleaming tea kettle with a plastic whistle in its spout shaped like a little red bird. Behind Louisa's back, Simone smiled beguilingly at Nora, who was consumed for the rest of the afternoon by one thought. Again. Sometimes Nora and Louisa babysat the little boy across the street, and what he loved most was for them to each take one of his hands and walk across the front lawn, swinging him by the arm high into the air. "Again!" he would shout, gleeful, the minute they reached the perimeter of the yard. They'd turn around and go back in the other direction, and before they even reached the fence on the opposite side, he'd start yelling, "Again! Again!" When he'd see them in the street, he'd start bouncing in his stroller. "Again!" he'd yell, waving at them. "Tomorrow, Lucas," they'd call. "We'll play tomorrow." There was never enough "again" for Lucas. No matter how many times Nora and Louisa swung him across the front lawn, until their arms were tired and their shoulders sore, no matter how they tried to refocus his attention with cookies or the swing or by playing peekaboo, when they stopped, he would cry and cry. After Simone, Nora knew exactly how he must have felt. Thought that the sensation he must love when being lifted off the ground, propelled forward by some bigger outside force, the swinging, the swoop of belly, the weightlessness, the sense of flying, it had to be almost sensual. A little kid precursor to pubescent desire, lust, hunger. Again was exactly how Nora felt after Simone kissed her. Nora couldn't stop thinking about the kiss, about the velvety feel of Simone's almond-flavored tongue in her mouth, about the almost imperceptible brush of Simone's fingers at her waist, or about when it might happen again. It didn't take long. The following week they went into a store to try on clothes, and Simone slipped into Nora's dressing room. The minute the door was closed, Simone had Nora pressed against the wall, and Nora did what she'd been thinking about doing all day and all night for a solid week. She kissed Simone back, exploring Simone's mouth with her tongue, biting her bright and full lower lip, grabbing fistfuls of Simone's long braids and wrapping them around both hands, and tugging lightly until Simone's head tilted back, exposing her long, elegant throat, and Nora fastened her mouth, the tip of her tongue, to the precise spot on Simone's neck where her pulse fluttered. That day, they'd pressed against each other until a saleswoman had gently knocked on the door and said, "How's it going in there? Anything working for you?" "Absolutely," Simone said, cupping Nora's ass and smiling. "Everything in here is working great." Soon, Nora and Simone figured out that the Museum of Natural History was the easiest place to lose Louisa. Like so much of New York, the crowds lent them a privacy that Simone's two-bedroom apartment couldn't. Louisa would bring her sketch pad and set to work, and Nora and Simone would say, "See you later," and then sneak away into a multitude of dimly lit corridors, empty restrooms, darkened screening areas. They became experts at exploring various body parts, triggering certain sensations without ever fully undressing. At first, they were tentative, a quick finger here, a flick of the tongue there. But they quickly learned where they could be brave, how to deftly circumvent buttons and waistbands and bra hooks while still staying clothed. Simone made Nora come for the first time in a restroom off the hall of invertebrates without even moving aside the slight bit of purple thong that Nora had bought on the sly and tucked into her backpack for this exact purpose. The first time Nora took Simone's breast into her mouth, down a deserted corridor of offices that were closed on the weekend, they'd almost been discovered by a lost mother looking for a restroom with her two little kids. Simone had hurriedly pulled on her T-shirt when they heard the kids running down the hall, the mother behind them yelling, "Don't touch the walls, guys. Hands to yourselves," which had reduced them to nearly hysterical laughter. While sitting in the deserted last row of the IMAX movie, later neither of them would remember what the movie was about. Nora inched Simone's tights down to her knees and slipped her fingers inside Simone's underwear and then inside Simone, who was warm and wet.
"Tell me what you want me to do," Nora whispered, dizzy and momentarily brave.
Simone held herself perfectly still and spoke softly into Nora's ear.
"Do me with your mouth."
When they met up later, Louisa frowned at Nora and said, "What have you guys been doing?"
"What do you mean?"
Nora's hands went clammy, her ears rang a little. She had checked to make sure Louisa wasn't in the theater.
"Your knees are filthy."
Louisa looked genuinely perplexed, peering at Nora, who seemed addled, almost feverish.
"Are you guys high?"
She lowered her voice and took a step closer to look at their eyes.
"No," Nora said. "We just got out of the IMAX."
"I dropped an earring," Simone said. Nora got down on the floor with me to look for it. It was dark. Simone did that thing with her voice, the tone of it, which made Louisa feel bad, like she'd said something wrong or stupid.
"Oh," Louisa said. "Did you find it?"
"Yup." Simone pointed to her ear and the series of tiny silver hoops along the lobe. Louisa didn't understand how one of those tiny hoops could have fallen, or how they could have found it in the dark, or why they were lying to her. Nora had never lied to Louisa, not in their entire lives. They were a few years past telling each other everything, every stray thought that flitted through their minds, their dreams, their dislikes, the explicit details of their crushes and desires. But they'd never lied to each other. Nora wanted to talk to Louisa, but she didn't know how to start. She would stand in their shared bathroom some mornings when Louisa was already downstairs having breakfast and practice saying something, anything, in the mirror.
"Hi, I'm gay," she'd rehearse.
She couldn't even say it with a straight face. It felt so melodramatic and dumb.
"Hi," she'd say to her reflection. "I like a girl."
That sounded dumb, too. "I'm sleeping with a girl?" Dumb. "I'm fucking a girl?" Wrong.
"I'm in love with a girl?"
Was she?
She wasn't even sure. "Just be honest,"
she could hear her mother's voice in her head. "Telling the truth is never wrong and always easier."
"Hi," she'd try. "I'm totally obsessed with a girl, and I don't know if I'm in love or even if I'm gay, but I'm so horny I can't see straight."
Well, that was the truth anyway.
"Oh, Lord," Simone had said when Nora tried to talk to her about it one afternoon at the museum.
They were both sitting on the floor, backs against the wall, in a relatively quiet spot, legs idly touching.
"Are you all topsy-turvy inside? All staring in a mirror and thinking, what does this mean? Who am I? What is my essential self now that I've kissed a girl?"
Nora was embarrassed. She didn't like being on the receiving end of Simone's pointed tongue. Well, except in certain ways.
"Are you all, now I have to listen to Melissa Etheridge all day and stop shaving my legs?"
Nora slapped Simone's arm lightly. "It's going to be so sad when you have to get your lesbian regulation crew cut," Simone continued, taking a healthy amount of Nora's chestnut curls in her hand. "I'm really going to miss this hair, but rules are rules."
"Forget it," Nora said. Now she felt dumb and angry. "Forget I said anything."
"I'm sorry I'm teasing you," Simone said, still playing with Nora's hair. "I can't help it. I like watching you blush. It's cute. You only turn pink right there."
She touched the middle of Nora's cheeks with her fingertips.
"It's like a trick."
Nora batted Simone's hand away. "It's just, I had a boyfriend last year."
"So did I."
"You did?"
"Sure. I don't have him anymore. He was very beautiful. Super sexy, but dumb as a rock. He kept talking about how he wanted to visit China because Mushu pork is the perfect food. God, he was dumb. But beautiful. Simone flashed her brilliant smile. Not as beautiful as you. I like you better if that's what you're worried about.
So what do you tell people?
What people?
I don't know. Everyone. Your friends, your parents. I mean, are you out?
First of all, I don't tell them anything because it's none of their business. I bring home boys. I bring home girls. It's not a big deal. Nora was staring at Simone, disbelieving. It couldn't possibly be that easy. It couldn't.
Am I hurting your feelings? Simone said. I'm not trying to hurt your feelings. I'm just not into labels. I don't believe you.
Why? I mean, if I were a boy, would you have to come out about it? Would you go home and say, Mom, there's something you need to know. I kissed a boy and I liked it.
It's not the same thing. Or maybe my parents are just nothing like yours.
Simone shrugged. I'd say that's a safe bet. She rebuttoned her lime green cardigan and stood up. My parents are cool. My mom's brother is gay and it wasn't easy for him. My grandparents were super religious and, well, they were really hard on him, always. But my mom and him, he's Simon, I'm named after him. They're really close. We're his family now.
My mother has a gay brother, too.
Nora was still sitting, looking up at Simone.
Really?
Simone said. Does she not approve?
No, no, Nora said, trying to think of an easy way to explain the Plum family and their various alliances and grievances. They're not close, but it's complicated. They're all kind of weird.
Everybody's kind of weird. Simone put her hand out for Nora, helping her to her feet. Your problem is you're worried about being everyone's mirror, and that's not your job. Nora braced herself. She could tell Simone was gearing up for one of her frequent and sometimes baffling extemporaneous lectures. Nora knew now just to listen and nod and say, Wow, I never thought of it that way. And then Simone would say, I live to elucidate. And then they could talk about something else.
Mirror?
Nora said, because Simone seemed to be waiting. Everyone's always on the hunt for a mirror. It's basic psychology. You want to see yourself reflected in others. Others, your sister, your parents. They want to look at you and see themselves. They want you to be a flattering reflection of them, and vice versa. It's normal. I suppose it's really normal if you're a twin. But being somebody else's mirror? That is not your job. Nora slumped against the wall a little. What Simone said made sense. A lot of sense. But so did wanting to see yourself in the people you love. So did wanting to reflect the people you love.
How do you know all this stuff? She asked Simone.
Some people have to learn this stuff sooner than others. Nora didn't have to ask what Simone meant. The previous week they'd been in the museum gift shop looking for candy when a couple had walked up to Simone and asked whether she knew where they could find a rock tumbling kit. No, I don't, she'd said, concentrating on the shelf of candy in front of her. They'd persisted. Well, can you find someone who will help us? Simone had turned to face them then and crossed her arms. No, I can't, she'd said, because I am not employed here. Like you, I am a customer. Even by Simone's standards, her tone was blistering. The couple flustered, apologized. We were just confused because you weren't wearing an overcoat, the woman said. Oh, I know exactly why you were confused, Simone had said. Hello? Simone tapped the top of Nora's shoe with hers, reclaiming her attention. Do you understand what I'm saying? Being somebody's looking glass is not your job.
I understand. I get it. But it's not just everyone else, it's me, too. I like definitions. I like to be sure of what's happening.
Simone put a consoling arm around Nora. You can be sure about me.
Nora wished they were alone.
She wished they could go somewhere and just be alone. If she told Louisa what was going on, maybe they could. Maybe they could stop these stupid afternoons at the museum, stop sneaking around. If somebody insists on a definition, Simone said, tell them you're bi-curious. That will shut them up, trust me. Nora was imagining telling her parents that she was bi-curious. God, she knew exactly what Melody would say, and she said it to Simone. That doesn't even sound like a real word. Maybe. But how does it feel? Simone asked, pressing Nora against the darkened back wall in a remote corner of the Hall of Biodiversity. How does it feel? Nora and Louisa talked about boys all the time, and it had never occurred to Louisa that Nora might actually want to be talking about girls. There were plenty of lesbians at their school, but they all seemed so dramatically lesbian with their short haircuts and black boots and tattoos and multiple piercings. They were so in-your-face lesbian, holding hands and making out in cars in the parking lot. Or there were the girls who play-acted at being lesbian, usually to flirt with boys, touching each other's hair and tentatively kissing on the lips, sometimes with tongues, and then laughing and pulling away, wiping their mouths with the back of their hands. But Louisa knew that what she'd seen between Nora and Simone wasn't either of those things. It wasn't statement, and it wasn't fashion. What she saw in the darkness of the museum was something else. It was lust. If Nora was gay, and they were twins, was she gay too? She liked boys, but she had to admit that when she'd seen Simone kiss Nora, watched the rise and fall of Nora's chest and Simone's hand move over Nora, her entire consciousness had reduced to one lasting image. Simone's thumb stroking Nora's nipple. But what did she want? To be touched by another person? A boy? A girl? Either? Both? She'd always imagined herself with a boy. But seeing Nora with a girl had upended something. Introduced a new possibility that was rooted in their twinness. This was the thing about having a twin, the enveloping, comforting, disconcerting thing. They were equal parts, and seeing the other doing something was almost like doing it yourself. You are each other's pulse, Melody would tell them all the time. And Louisa believed it. She didn't always like it, but she believed it. When their father had taught them how to ride a two-wheeler, Louisa was terrified. Every time he let go of her bike, she felt the loosening at the back wheel and stopped pedaling in sheer terror, and her bike would slow and wobble and tip, and she'd have to jump off and free herself from the spinning spokes and whirring pedals. "Let's let Nora have a go," Walt finally said. Then it was Nora's turn. Nora, who was always more fearless, more agile, and when Louisa watched her father run with Nora's bike and then release the back tire and saw Nora lean into the pedals, pump her legs faster, give the bike the speed and ballast it needed to stay upright, it was almost as if she'd done it herself. She could feel it exactly. Watching Nora's body do something gave her the concurrent muscle memory. The next time Louisa tried the bike and her father let go, she flew. Chapter 21. Woman. Runner. Literary agent. Single. Stephanie looked over her list, the four words she'd hastily written to describe herself to a room mostly full of strangers. "Don't think too hard," Cheryl, the cheerful woman running the team-building session, had said. "Jot down the first four words that pop into your head. No editing your first impulse and no job titles." Stephanie crossed out literary agent and in its place wrote reader, which was more accurate anyway, describing what she was supposed to be doing all day but never actually had time to do until the evenings or weekends. She was a little stung that she'd written single, was surprised to see it emerge from the spongy ooze of her uncaffeinated subconscious. It had been 4 days since she surreptitiously switched the coffee beans to decaf. Leo hadn't even noticed, and she still felt groggy, as if her brain stayed at half-mast for most of the morning. But single was not how she ever thought of herself. She considered her list again, thought about erasing single and replacing it with something else. New Yorker? Foodie? Gardener? But that would be cheating, and everyone else at the table seemed to be finished. Stephanie very much wanted this day to end. The first of three infuriating, obligatory days of employee orientation. The corporation she'd sold her agency to, a behemoth of entertainment representation, film, television, music, headquartered in Los Angeles and wanting a literary presence for their New York office, insisted on the training. She knew this was just the first of many irritations she would have to endure after running her own office with the beloved, if quirky, group of employees she'd worked with for so long. She was trying to be patient, but this was bullshit. Days of icebreakers, group dynamics, and sexual harassment seminars. What did any of this have to do with her or her employees? They already knew how to work together. And they worked together well because each